This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, Music from DePauw. This week, we preview our upcoming chorus and band concerts. We formally announce the adoption of the Greencastle Middle School Music Program by the School of Music. We strand our director of libraries on a desert island with a 5-minute iPod. And we welcome to the studio via Skype one of the most dangerous academics in America, who will be here on campus this week for a series of events. There are lots of exciting things happening in the School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. On Friday night, October the 5th, at 7:30 in Kresge Auditorium, will be the first concert of the year by the University Chorus and Chamber Singers. And we've invited two folks into the studio to tell us all about this. Our director, Dr. Greg Risto, welcome.
Thank you.
And the artist formerly known as Little Red Riding Hood, just after her successful performance weekend with Into the Woods, Elika Okerstrom. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
So, you guys have a concert coming up. Tell me about it.
Well, we've titled it Sings and Queens. It's music about singing, and then pieces written in honor of the various ruling queens of England.
I see. And so, what types of things are on the concert?
We're opening with a wonderful piece by Daniel Gothrop called Sing a Mighty Song, which is not as well known as it should be, but it's this beautiful just expression of the joys of singing and why we sing. And that's the whole theme for the University Chorus portion of the program. We have a piece by Fanny Hensel, who was Felix Mendelssohn's sister, which is about I love to sing outside from her whole cycle called Gartenlieder or Garden Songs. When chamber singers take the stage, we move on to the queens portion of Sings and Queens, and we're doing music written for Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Victoria, and Queen Elizabeth II.
Ah, wonderful. So, Elika, how's this music this semester going with the choir?
I've really enjoyed it, actually. It's very different than what we were performing last year. It's nice to take music that may sometimes seem simple, but by no means
as easy.
Not as easy as it may look on a page. For example, all the 1601 madrigals, while like, oh, thank God we're singing something tonal, is incredibly difficult. It's all about learning how to tune these chords impeccably. So it's been a learning experience for us, especially how to work together as a group.
It's amazingly complex stuff for something so simple on the ear.
It is.
You know, it really is quite the challenge. And I love this piece that you're opening with, this Dan Gothrop piece. He's very much about the joy of
singing.
Simply singing.
Yes.
Right. This is fantastic. So how many people are involved in the University Chorus?
We have about 60 people in University Chorus.
Wow. And in the chambers?
And in chamber singers, it's 24.
Wow. Folks might be interested to know that these aren't just School of Music students.
That's right. Especially in University Chorus, we have about a third of University Chorus are CLA students.
Wow, that's fantastic. And another way that the School of Music and the College of Liberal Arts work together is here on stage together in performance. And all of our ensembles are open by audition to anybody regardless of their major. So we have a long history of having non-music majors in the U course, correct?
That's right, absolutely.
And then you've just completed a little surprise weekend, because we're all thrilled because we've opened up a Starbucks in town. And the chamber singers have done a little surprise there for us.
That's right, we have done a little surprise. Yeah.
And so why don't we go ahead and let the cat out of the bag? What did you do?
We sang Penny Lane of the Beatles, which we did last semester, and we still have it in our reps. We just brushed that up. And then also two of our madrigals that we're going to sing on Friday.
And this is great fun because this is not a planned concert. So it's not like there's a stage. It's just a busy day at Starbucks. The lieutenant governor's here and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. And then suddenly people start singing in the middle of the Starbucks.
That's right.
And I love that type of pop-up concert. Project Trio did it for us when they were here. You guys have done it for us now. We're always interested in trying to share music at every opportunity. And this is a wonderful program that really covers a wide variety of music and another way to reach out to our community. So we're talking about composers born in the mid-1500s.
That's right.
To composers born in the mid-1900s.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And this is such a joyous program.
It is.
Did you come after it that way? You thought, I just want to be joyful this time.
You know, I honestly, when I plan, I keep just these lists of pieces I want to do, and then I start looking at them and saying, what's going to sound good with the singers that we have?
Mm.
And then sort of shaking them up until they start to fall into some logical program order, and these just kept bubbling to the top, and yeah.
So, Alika, are you in both groups?
No, I'm just in Chamber Singers.
Just in Chamber Singers, okay. Mm-hmm. And do you ever put the two together?
Yes, in fact, we're closing the whole program with If Music Be the Food of Love.
Play on.
Or sing on. The words are changed a little bit.
Well, yes, we've modified just a bit. Yes, yeah. I see that. Well, it won't be the first time he's been paraphrased.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming in to chat about it, and we look forward to your performance.
Thank you.
Oh.
This is a week of exciting performances at DePauw, both inside and outside the School of Music. On Wednesday night will be Percussion at Peeler, which is where our percussion ensemble performs in the Peeler Art Museum. And then on Thursday night is a performance by George Wolfe as one of our faculty select series concerts. And I've asked Dr. Eric Edberg to come in and tell us a bit about the unusual career and performance of George Wolfe. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Dr. McCoy. George Wolfe is one of the most unusual and delightful colleagues that I've come across in my career. He is both the saxophone professor and the former director of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at Ball State. So George is somebody who really embodies being a performing musician and a scholar in a kind of dual career.
Now, isn't he also one of the world's most dangerous people or whatever? How
well, yes,
that exactly?
The conservative commentator and writer David Horowitz, I think in 2004, named George as one of the 101 most dangerous academics in America.
That's it, the 101 most dangerous academics. What a great thing to put on your bio.
It's great. And George said it got him a lot more speaking gigs. So he's eternally grateful to David Horowitz for doing that. That came about as a result of a piece called Weapons of Mass Distortion that George started performing. It's by a composer named Martin Wesley Smith. It's a piece for a video projection and solo saxophone that was written after the invasion of Iraq, which the then administration claimed was because of
weapons of mass destruction,
which turned out not to exist.
Right. So now, will we get to hear this piece?
And even though it's a little bit dated now because of that invasion was a long time ago, I've asked George to perform that piece.
That's
and
terrific.
He will be doing that. And in a program called Music as a Medium of Metaphor and Protest. And he'll also be playing a piece called Phoenix by the composer Ryo Noda, and Three Universes by Jody Nagel, who's a composer at Ball State, who does a lot of things for pre-recorded sounds and acoustic instrument. And that piece will have that and narration, and I will be narrating.
Oh, great. So yet another talent of Eric Edberg comes to the stage now, the voice of
the
Eric
voice
Edberg.
Of Eric Edberg,
yes. There you go. Now, people might think that composers commenting on political issues is new. But it's really not. I mean, we can, even Beethoven. I mean, we
right,
Beethoven 3, you know, we don't have to get to it.
That's right. The symphony that was dedicated to Napoleon Bonaparte until he
decided that it wasn't.
Right, until Napoleon declared himself emperor and Beethoven scratched out the dedication to Napoleon with such force that there's actually a hole in the manuscript.
Right.
So, you know, the music as something that's powerful, that can protest, that can make comment on things that are going on in the culture. That's been part of music for its entire history.
And it's interesting because this week at DePauw, we'll have these two concerts back to back, one actually in the School of Music, one in the Green Center for the Performing Arts, and one out. And we're bringing two different types of things to light in a single week. One is music written by composers that is a direct reflection of the society. And the other is actually the performance within the society rather than in the concert hall. We have percussion at Peeler. And this is not an unusual idea either.
No, it's not. And I think it's a really wonderful thing that Dr. Amy Lynn Barber does in taking the percussion ensemble to other spaces. It's really important as classical musicians that we go out and find audiences, that we don't only play in rooms that were built for listening to music. Now, we're lucky at DePauw. I mean, we're extraordinarily fortunate that we have two of the finest concert halls in the world, I think,
really.
It's they're acoustic marvels, both Kresge Auditorium and Thompson Recital Hall. But there are a lot of people who don't go to concerts in concert halls.
Right.
And art galleries are a wonderful venue for performing. There is a chamber music series in Phoenix started by Mark Dix, who is a violist in the Phoenix Symphony, called the Downtown Chamber Series, and they play only in art galleries and museums and other unusual spaces.
Wow.
And Mark feels passionately that traditional concert halls and the kind of second most frequent venue for chamber music concerts, churches, he just finds them kind of visually dead. And he loves the stimulation that comes with being in a space where the space itself is designed to be visually stimulating and where there are changing sets of artworks. Mm-hmm. And when you perform in a museum or an art gallery, in addition to the audience relating to the music and to the performers, there's this kind of third party, which is the,
right.
which
the art itself.
The artworks, yeah. Right. And you also get the fact that, especially in the Peeler Gallery here at DePauw, there's no stage. Mm-hmm. There's often only a few chairs or sometimes no chairs. And these concerts are always different, always fascinating. But the performing space and the listening space, which are very separate from each other in a recital hall or a concert hall or even at a church, intermingle and they shift around.
Right. I remember last year at the Percussion of Peeler concert, which was my first opportunity to hear that concert. It was interesting to be seated among the percussionists as they were playing and watch them reach for different instruments and hear them take the prep breath and things that you would never see or hear from the seats in Kresge, for example.
Yeah, yeah. So they're both extraordinary experiences.
Mm-hmm. Just and radically
hearing,
different.
Hearing the percussion ensemble in Kresge Auditorium is a fantastic thing. But that kind of intimacy and that kind of integration between the audience members and the performers is a really special thing.
And in an art museum, there's also an acoustical property because of the nature of art museums, which are mostly bare walls so that their art stands out, and they're square. So we get this interesting reverb in an art museum that's different than the reverb we would get in a concert hall, but at least there it is a live sound, where there's a lot of places you can play, and you just it's just not a very conducive to music type of environment, and an art museum very much so. So here we have a 1-2 punch in 2 days. We have a great performance at Peeler and followed that up with the George Wolfe performance, which will be in Thompson, another wonderful acoustic space. Both of these concerts are ways in which musicians are reacting to and being a part of society today.
Yeah, and I'm also delighted that we were able to work things out that George Wolfe is speaking at the Peace Camp that we have at DePauw, where a number of students and some faculty actually go and live in the academic quad in cardboard boxes for the week, and there's a series of speaking events. So George is talking on Tuesday afternoon about building a positive, proactive peace at the Peace Camp, and then on Thursday at 11:30 in the morning before his recital that night, he's talking at what we call the Conflict Commons, a speaker series presented by the Conflict Studies Department on peace building in a pluralistic interfaith world.
Right.
So I think on Wednesday morning when we have our School of Music recital hour and George plays and George and I talk, and George also improvises as I do, and we're going to improvise together both on Wednesday morning and his concert on Thursday, you get to see an example of somebody who has followed his scholarship in a different domain than music, but one that certainly overlaps with music, and also become a world-class performer. I think it's going to be really fascinating for our students.
Yeah, thank you for bringing him here. I think this is going to be an exciting week, and this is truly the way a school of music and a college of liberal arts can best interact. Here, this person comes in as really the hallmark of that. This is a person who has succeeded in both realms very well and appeals to both institutions equally, and to have him here on one campus, and he must be eating Superman food for that week because his performance is so little time, but it's great that he's here, and thanks for making that happen for us.
You're welcome.
And for coming in to chat.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Last week, we had the announcement that the School of Music at DePaul University was going to adopt the music program at Greencastle Middle School. With me in the studio is the principal of Greencastle Middle School, Tamara Walker. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And the music teacher there, Catherine Drury. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So we're thrilled at this adoption, and I guess last Wednesday was the big kickoff of it. And I have to say, I don't think I've ever gone to a middle school performance where the kids were that quiet. Is it always that way?
It is not always that way. They were definitely engaged.
And so we took Project Trio out, and Principal Walker announced to the kids this adoption and introduced Project Trio, and those kids were really into it.
They were into it.
In fact, they wanted more.
Yeah. And a lot of them came that night, which was really great.
They did. I had about 20 come back for the evening performance.
And you know what's funny is I had two different parents, and then one actually emailed me, and then one last night at dinner. So that's four now that have mentioned this to me. But the first one that stopped me in the Great Hall after the performance came up to me and said, "Hi, I'm a parent from Greencastle Middle School. My kid came home and demanded that we go to this concert, and I was just really kind of put out, but I drove over here for this concert, and then I bought all four of their CDs, and these guys are really fantastic."
We had kind of a similar response because we have several teachers at the middle school who are parents of band or choir students, and so even right after school, we had teachers, a couple of them, "I guess we're going to a concert tonight."
Right, they found out, yeah. And it was funny, this the response from parents who said, "My child informed me that this is where we are." this point, and the number of CDs that they bought. You know, I had a parent last night who told me that I think they have an eighth grader, and their eighth grader is getting the Project CD for their birthday.
Excellent.
We have to say, I think the free tickets helped.
Reaching out into the community with free tickets for students is really important to us, not just to PAW students, but for all of the students in the area. And it's great for us to see these young kids be so turned on to music in our performance spaces. And of course, Project is such a high energy group that really helps. Now we'll have another group right around the corner, Voces 8. They're coming in from England, and we'll also offer free tickets, and we'll send out the email about that as well and invite everyone to that one. So we've started this process kind of quietly, and we've already been at the school a bit. We've sent some students and faculty out that have been helping you teach. How has that been going for you?
It has been going very well. Dr. Paré has been in several times already. The percussion students are just eating it up, and they are just so excited.
Yeah, and I think the average person might be surprised to know that the band director at a high school or a middle school or an elementary school has to know how to play every instrument. They have.
That's right.
But one person being able to play all those instruments well is just completely out of any reasonable expectation. So when we can bring you experts on these instruments
exactly.
into your classroom,
exactly,
it really can make it. And how many kids do you have in your program?
I have 240.
So this is one music teacher with 240 students.
And let me just add, if I may, that this is the first time that one person that I know of, that one person is doing band and choir. So she has six different preps.
Right.
So sixth grade band, sixth grade choir, et cetera. So
yeah.
We certainly are benefiting already from your expertise here in the School of Music.
Thank you very much. On Wednesday, we'll announce the scheduling process because some students have already been out, but it's been kind of less formal. Now we'll have a scheduling process where students will sign up to come out, and you'll know in advance of who's coming. But what an incredible opportunity for our students to get hands-on teaching experience and for you to have an extra set of hands or another voice in the room.
Exactly. It's a win-win.
It sure is.
It really is. My students are going to benefit so much for having some extra help, extra set of hands. But the DePaul students will also benefit because they get that hands-on experience.
Right. And for a kid, you know, this is really exciting. I remember this happening to me, too, when I was just in middle school. When someone came in and played my instrument next to me, I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. You know, that, wow, listen to that. You mean I can make my horn sound like that person's horn? So that's particularly exciting.
And the fact that they can hear the way that is exactly supposed to be played,
right.
And then they can try to imitate that sound, goes volumes.
And there's so many other things we're hoping to see happen in this process. We're hoping to start an after-school jazz ensemble, and we're hoping to help out with some instrument purchases. And as we continue to work on granting possibilities for this, it'll evolve into more things. But this is part of the School of Music's effort to be involved in the community, to do what we can to make Greencastle and Putnam County a more attractive place for everyone. And I can't imagine anything better than music coming from middle school kids.
Yes, and if I may add, mm-hmm. what I appreciate probably most from you and your faculty is your commitment level already, and the fact that when we had our initial conversation about this potential partnership, you said, we're concerned about sustainability, mm-hmm. and we don't want to do this just for 1 year, and right. that our commitment, in fact, will be multi-year.
Right.
And so that's certainly appealing to us and to the students, you know, who have been let down before mm-hmm. by other, you know, 1 year deals. So
right.
As principal of the middle school, I appreciate that.
We're always looking for ways to help, and grants are always hard to come by. And we're always looking for ways we can make this sustainable. Well, we're close enough by, and we've certainly got enough students who are interested in doing it. It's a win-win situation. They get teaching experience. Your kids get great experience from experts on their horns or on their voice parts. And this can grow into all kinds of wonderful things. So we're all excited to see where it goes.
Yes, we're excited about the future of music at Greencastle Middle School.
That's for sure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joining us to chat about what is on his 5-minute iPod is Rick Provine, the Director of Libraries. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. And actually, I'm surprised we've let you in the studio since you had stolen the name of our show. The name of our show is Music for Life, and we're happy with that. But as we were batting about names for Music for Life, we were considering Dancing About Architecture. And it turned out you already had a radio show called Dancing About Architecture.
And I have had for about 6 or 7 years now.
So we couldn't have it. And you might want to tell our audience what that quote alludes to.
Well, maybe we can negotiate the ownership of it. It's a quote that's been difficult to attribute to its source. The whole quote is, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. And it's kind of a musician's revenge against criticism, that how can you write about something like music? And I've just always thought it was a very telling and in very few words, says quite a bit. And
absolutely.
As a musician myself, I've always appreciated that.
Right. We're fortunate here at DePauw that our director of libraries is not just a librarian, but he's also a musician. He's a fine drummer, and in fact, such a fine drummer that on several occasions we have invited him in to play with DePauw ensembles and even have him anchor the big band here at DePauw behind the set. And he's also a frequent performer with jazz musicians from the School of Music in our Jazz at the Duck series.
I feel very fortunate to be able to do that. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's so good for our students to see folks outside of the School of Music as outstanding musicians. So
see,
thank you for being
there. Old fat guys can still do this.
So you're stuck on a desert island. You've got an iPod, but it's broken, and it will only play for 5 minutes. What is playing on your 5-minute iPod?
Spain by Chick Corea.
Excellent choice. Why?
I played in jazz band in high school, and I started doing that simply because I'd been in band in high school and came to it before I really had a great deal of knowledge of jazz. But we hosted a jazz festival each year, and actually a DePauw adjunct professor, or who later became a DePauw adjunct professor, John Spickman, was the jazz band director at ISU at that time. This is in about the mid-70s. And they performed, and they did a rendition of Spain, and I'm not certain it was the first time I heard it, but it was certainly the first time I'd seen it performed live. And it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. So you take yourself back to 1974 or so. Things were still transitioning. A lot of jazz bands were still dressing alike, and it was a fairly kind of buttoned-up affair. The ISU jazz band came in, and they had on jeans and beads, and they looked so cool. And instead of percussion behind the solos and on the choruses, they shook their car keys, they dropped their change in their mutes and shook it around. And it was just one of the most organic and accessible jazz performances I had seen to that point in my life. And I loved it. And I went back, and I know soon after that, bought Light as a Feather, the album that it was originally recorded on.
Right.
And it's just one of those songs that, to me, has everything.
Everybody loves that chart. They're clapping along with you. They love that break in the middle.
It's one of the hits of jazz.
It really is. It's like really a top 40 hit.
Yeah.
It appeals to everybody, no matter what their prior experience with jazz is. So thank you for bringing us from Light as a Feather, Spain by Chick Corea. And thanks for being here, Rick.
My pleasure.
This is an exciting week in the School of Music, as we have a special guest coming to visit us. George Wolfe, who is the professor of saxophone at Ball State University, but also has led a fascinating dual career, is coming to DePauw, and my, is this man busy. We will have him doing a saxophone masterclass on Tuesday at 11:30. He will be a part of the Peace Camp at 4 p.m. that day. On Wednesday, he will be in our student recital hour discussing his dual career. Immediately after the recital hour, he will move into an improv workshop with our improvised chamber ensemble. On Thursday, he'll address the Conflict Commons. And then at 6:30 is the culminating event, which is a recital at 6:30 on Thursday night in Thompson Recital Hall of George Wolfe, this remarkable saxophonist who has performed around the world. He's been a soloist with the Navy Band, the Saskatoon Symphony, the World Band at Disney World. And he's also very famous for his book and for his work. And at one point was even noted as one of the 101 most dangerous academics in America. So we're pleased to welcome one of the most dangerous academics in America to Music for Life. Hello, George Wolfe.
Hi, good to be here. Thank you very much.
George is also on the cutting edge technologically because we're having this interview via Skype. So George is in his office and we're here in the studio and we're able to chat. And I very much appreciate your taking time to chat with us today, George.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to my visit.
Yes, I said in an interview earlier with Eric Edberg, who helped us organize your visit, that you must be Superman because you're doing so many things while you're here.
Well, you know, it's interesting. All this came out of my desire years ago of trying to bring meaning to my music. And, you know, a lot of people get hobbies going in their life. And I decided if I was going to create a hobby, I wanted all my hobbies to connect with my specialty in the music field. And so everything just kind of integrates together. And I sort of don't feel like I'm being pulled in different directions. I feel like I'm just capitalizing on various mediums to bring my thoughts to the public.
So tell our audience a little bit about your work in conflict studies and your book and about your non-saxophone world, and then we'll come back and chat about your musician's life next.
Well, in 1991, I guess it was, I received a grant from the Eli Lilly Endowment for an open fellowship, and it was to go to India to study Hindustani or North Indian music. And while I was in India, I became exposed to Indian philosophy and philosophy also of Mahatma Gandhi, became very interested in the nonviolent revolution that took place in India. And then when I came back from India, I wanted to become a board member of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at Ball State. That was open to my my interest. So I became board member and I became active in the center in various ways. Mm-hmm. Then in the year 2002, the director of the center decided to retire. She'd been director for about 12 years. And my doctorate is actually not in music. My master's is in music performance from Indiana University, but my doctorate is in higher education administration. So I was appointed as the director of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies for, it was supposed to be for 3 years, but it turned out to be four. which was all right with me.
Those things have a way of going on, don't they?
Yes. So that's how I got involved in a more leadership position in the field of peace studies. And then while I was director there, that was at a time when America had launched the preemptive invasion of Iraq and so forth, and 80% of the American people were in favor of that. And I was teaching a course in the history and philosophy of nonviolence, and a neoconservative advocate in the social political world named David Horowitz decided that he would politically attack peace studies programs around the country, and he particularly focused on peace studies programs that were in public universities because, you know, taxpayers' money was paying my salary and so forth. So that's how I became a target for that, and I was honored to be included in his book, 101 Most Dangerous Academics in America, because I was teaching a course on peace studies and nonviolence while America was engaged in a preemptive war.
And so I'm sure that only increased folks' interest in having you come and chat about that.
Well, that too, and also the enrollment in peace studies at Ball State tripled as a result.
David Horowitz.
I learned to apply Gandhi's philosophy of how to take negative energy and transform it into something positive and to transform it into a positive direction in one's own life. That's one thing I'm going to be speaking about at the peace camp is building a positive, proactive peace. And I talk about how we take the negative energy that comes through anger and how we reflect on it and learn to transform it into a positive energy.
And so how has this impacted your music?
You know, this is one thing people would ask, well, what in the world is a saxophone player doing as a director of peace studies? Well, people forget that the arts have been an important medium for social activism and social protest, political activism, and that goes back a long time. And so the idea of integrating music and, of course, for other faculty members at Ball State and other schools, you know, theater and poetry and so forth, integrating that into a message of activism, that isn't a strange concept at all. That's
right.
That's very much a part of the whole idea of active nonviolence.
And so you have a very interesting work that you're going to perform for us, I think by special request, about weapons of mass distortion.
That's right. That's the title of a brilliant composition, in my estimation, by Martin Wesley Smith, who is a composer from Australia. And he calls the work Weapons of Mass Distortion. And it's a video acoustic work. It was written in protest to the preemptive invasion of Iraq. And, of course, Australia was very much involved in supporting that. So he integrates political issues and themes from the Australian perspective as well as from an American perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so is all of your work now as a musician directly tied to your work in peace studies?
Well, you know, you can look at music in three ways with regards to the meaning of performance. The first way is a lot of people look at music as entertainment. Mm-hmm. People come to a recital or an orchestra concert or to be entertained. Another way to look at it is from the standpoint of education. In other words, you can play a piece of music and it provides entertainment, but you also can tell people something about the composition, which is educational. And in some cases, that educational aspect can be multicultural. For example, another piece I'm performing on the concert is by a Japanese composer named Ryunoda. And Ryunoda was a shakuhachi flute player, and he's written several unaccompanied pieces for a concert saxophone, which is designed to try to make the saxophone sound like a shakuhachi flute. And when I talk about that, when I speak about that or hand out program notes about that, I'm able to educate the audience, provide information which most people find quite interesting about Japanese culture, about what the shakuhachi flute is, and about how the saxophone can be made to imitate that in certain ways. So that's an educational dimension, and I'm very active in that. And then the third way that I look at music is as having a message, which is actually an activist message, either politically or socially or whatever.
Right.
You could say that the performance of this piece I'm doing by Ryunoda called Phoenix, that has an educational dimension to it in addition to the entertainment dimension.
Right.
And then Weapons of Mass Distortion goes a step further and has the activist dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my music, it's still integrated together, and sometimes I'll do a concert and I'll focus mostly on the educational. This one I'm putting more together because it's connected with the peace camp, and I thought Weapons of Mass Distortion would be an excellent example of how music can be used as a medium for activism.
This is perfect timing to have you on campus. We've been talking about how the students can use music to impact their world quite a bit here in the School of Music lately. And I've given the example many times that if you were to walk into a room and just play one note on a piano, you've changed the room. But imagine what would happen if you went out and you played out on the lawn or on the town square, or you went to a school and performed, or you went to a senior's home and performed, or in our case recently, our school of music has adopted the music program at a local middle school, and these folks can go out and have a very great impact on their world by simply doing the thing that they do best, which is mm-hmm. make music.
Sure.
And you've done that very thing here in a far larger sense and in a fascinating variety of ways. And we certainly look forward to having you here on campus. We owe you a deep debt of gratitude for your flexibility and your commitment to do so much in so few days. But we're glad that you're coming to campus, and we look forward to having you here. And we certainly look forward to all of these events, including your culminating performance on Thursday night at 6:30. Thank you for taking a few moments to chat with us about it, and we look forward to welcoming you on campus soon.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to my visit.
Okay, take care. On Sunday, October the 7th at 3 p.m. in Kresge Auditorium, the School of Music proudly presents the first performance of the year by the University Band. And we welcome Dr. Craig Paré, our conductor, to tell us about it.
Thank you, Dr. Bukoy. Our first performance features both the University Band and large symphonic works. The new concept of having pieces that we're regularly going to feature as a wind ensemble. For the former, we're going to feature several larger works, a Wind Sprints of Richard Sauzedo, who is the director of bands at Carmel High School in Indianapolis, American Overture for Band by Joseph Wilcox Jenkins, which is considered a staple of symphonic literature, another staple that's over the last 5 or 6 years become a perennial favorite at this time of year, October, by Eric Whitaker, a piece we recorded on one of our CDs called Star Splitter by Philip Rothman, wonderful piece for color and just the whole concept of shaping and sounds and different colors and textures within an ensemble. The piece we're going to feature with the wind ensemble is a piece for 10 winds called Dectet by a younger composer, Alex Murray. It features a soprano saxophone, alto tenor and barry as a quartet, and then two flutes, two oboes, and two clarinets. The Screamer by Fred Jewell, which has been edited by Barry Kopetz, is our march for this performance, and then we're going to finish the program with a finale to Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. I regularly like to perform works that are part of the transcription repertoire that we have. I really like to feature part of our heritage as bands and what Sousa and a variety of the professional bands early in the 20th century featured before there was really a good body of literature, original works.
Right. When you think about the advent of the American band, the brass bands from the Civil War and the draw for those musicians who played mostly brass instruments. Mm-hmm. And then early 20th century, we move into Philip Sousa and all of the great march repertoire. And the truth of it is, the band's a relatively new invention, and we were looking for music to play.
Yes, only a little over 100 years old. We think back to the Holt Suites, where 1909, 1910. Right. And before then, and even through a good part of the 20th century up to the 40s and 50s, we relied on transcriptions for the body of our literature until Persichetti, Morton Gould, William Schumann started to come along and write original works.
Right. Thank God for Holst and Vaughan Williams early on, yes, who adapted their writing to the idea and adopted the new ensemble, mm-hmm, to make it happen. But prior to those folks who really paved the way with this great canon of literature that we now have for band, then we didn't. And we did it largely by transcribing orchestral works, mm-hmm, for the band. So it's interesting to have this opportunity to hear Tchaikovsky played, mm-hmm, without strings.
That's right.
Because it really puts these wind players through their paces.
It has. And they've enjoyed tackling this work. It's an appropriate work for this group.
Right. I would often have clarinet players tell me, but this is much easier on a violin. And my response would always be, but I didn't choose the instrument. You know, you did. And so this is a piece of work. But this is a nice variety of a program because you'd kind of tip our hat to our heritage, both with the march, one of the world's great marches, mm-hmm, right there, and a really exciting march, and with the transcription. But then you're also coming into the newer material, mm-hmm, too. Star Splitter, which you guys have on a CD that's available on iTunes.
CD, that's right.
Right. So is that the title track of that CD?
It is.
Yeah,
Star Splitter.
So if you want to hear that, you can get that on iTunes at any time. Mm-hmm. One of the neat things that the School of Music band program does is record a professional CD. So every other year we put out a new album, mm-hmm, and it's available through Amazon or iTunes or wherever.
I'm proud to also be able to say that we're on the Naxos online library. They carry us now, so anyone who has access to the website here in the music library, almost all our CDs are available on there now.
Right, and so it's an incredible opportunity for our students to feel what it's like to be in a, mm-hmm, professional recording situation and have those challenges, and it's also a great opportunity for our prospective students and our alumni and everyone to be able to get a hold of us online in a lot of ways, Naxos, iTunes, Amazon, whatever. There's all kinds of ways to make that happen. So is there a favorite in this concert?
There's not. I find that I really try to put together, from concert to concert, an eclectic variety of works that really do look over our shoulder to older literature, that are pieces that the ink is still drying, mm-hmm, to works that are really a distinctive particular composer that students here might not have studied. For example, later this year we're going to do a Frank Zappa work that he wrote only two or three pieces for wind ensemble. So I really try to use a concert as kind of a mini survey of what wind literature has been, some of the staples of what's considered right now good symphonic band and wind ensemble literature, and looking to the future, pieces that are brand new that need to be heard, that deserve to be heard.
And another way that the university band displays its relevance and reaches out into the community in an unusual way is we also tie in with a food drive every year.
We do. I ask that when people come to the performance that they bring one particular item, and I usually turn to the director, Judy Miller, that helps us understand what her needs are currently at any particular time throughout the year, whether it's canned food or particular types of food. But we feel that as we come together as a community, it's just to bring one thing per person isn't too much of a struggle, I think, even if it's a can of soup. Mm-hmm. But when we bring together and come away with 200 to 300 items that we can help stock their shelves with,
right.
To me, it's a worthy effort.
Yeah, and it's a great way for us to make a difference in our community, not just musically, because we all believe that by playing this music, our community is a better place already.
Mm-hmm.
But also we reach out to those less fortunate, and it's a great time of year to do that, and this is a great vehicle to get it done. So I'm glad that you do that each year.
Thank you.
And it's been great to chat with you about this. We'll take this out now with a little of this beautiful Eric Whitaker piece called October. Thanks for coming in to chat about
Thanks, Dr. McCoy.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Music for Life. We love hearing from listeners. You can contact us by emailing musicforlife@depauw.edu. Our student producers are Bia Dagaford, Anna Gatdula, Adam Luman, Frederico Poppy, and Matthew Skiba. Our online editor is Veronica Pedrell, and our show is produced and recorded by Matthew Champagne in the Judson and Joyce Green Center for the Performing Arts at DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana. I'm Mark McCoy, Dean of the School of Music. Thanks for listening to our show. Keep music in your life, and have a great week.
It's Music for Life.